WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
All right.
What's wrong?
Well, you're in the mask, so that's going to be...
What do you mean, in the mask?
The microphone is underneath the mask.
There's no microphone?
Yeah, there's a microphone right here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what do you want me to be doing?
So take the mask off.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
So let's do the mask first, and then we'll put the earbuds in.
I put the mask on first.
Yes. But we have to take it out of here.
It's so hard to be a reporter.
And then take this off here. Okay. So let's just mask on.
The other day, Patricia Marks got suited up by her producer, Stephen Valentino. And Patty and Stephen headed out to Citi Field to see the Mets take on the Colorado Rockies.
Okay, so we're...
Are you sure we're heading in the right place?
Yeah.
Like we're heading somewhere that with it's advertising discount mufflers.
It wasn't just any game. This was the first game of the season with a vaccinated seating section where you could sit in a big group of your friends and yell and cheer and chant and curse, just like the days of yore. And Patty was psyched.
So finally, after about 263 years, I was going to get to go to a baseball game and sit in the vaccinated section at Citi Field.
Okay, so we should get our vaccine cards and our IDs and our tickets.
And now, of course, we have to find our seats. We pretty much took everything except a hot air balloon to get to the stratosphere where our seats in section 534 were.
We're up above, we're one more up.
Oh, yeah.
So we have to walk it.
It's probably unfashionable to say, but I love baseball. I love baseball for all the reasons most people hate baseball. I love that it's so slow. It's like life that way. When you go to the restroom and you come back, you don't say, what happened? Because you know you'll figure it out eventually, and it may not matter in the long run anyway. I have loved baseball ever since I was a kid and used to go to Phillies games with my father. And every night when he came back from work, I would practice my pitching with him because I was determined to be a pitcher for the Phillies.
Well, this is our first game of the season, and I haven't been to a game for, in fact, a couple of years, and I'm amazed at how few people are here. It's the first game where vaccinated, unvaccinated people can come. Were you surprised?
Yeah, this is our first game too, back for a long time. I thought the vaccinated section would have more people, for sure.
We actually tried to get tickets today, and we were having trouble getting tickets, and I don't understand why.
We did too!
Yeah.
What? Maybe they should be a little more welcoming.
Yeah.
It's
we have the whole section to ourselves. We could sit wherever we want.
You'd think that they would sort of favor us.
Yeah. I actually said I thought that the vaccinated people should get better seats instead of way up top where we are.
And throw them out. Pitcher covering. The 0-1.
On top of nobody there, it was fucking freezing. It was like the ambience on top of Mount Everest.
What do you think it says about the world reopening that we're here?
I think that it's very curious that the world is reopening and nobody came. I think that maybe people, somebody tried to get a, somebody meaning a Met, I guess a Met.
It's a Met.
It's really hard to tell the difference up here, but a Met tried to catch a foul ball and he fell into the stands.
I was expecting a big draw. I mean, New York has reopened. We have a.
I think a lot of people too. It's really exciting that we're allowed to be with other people and watch baseball. And the Mets are doing really well. They're in first place. Maybe people don't like winners. I don't know. But they could be watching the Colorado Rockies or losers. So there's a little bit for everybody. You do feel like a sucker for being here.
I mean, this is kind of sad.
Kinda? Why did you put kinda in front of that? This is very sad. What? It's a Tuesday night. Clearly something else.
It's a Monday night.
A Monday night. Something else better is happening. There must be a special at the supermarket at Morton Williams on chicken thighs or something. Which, you know, that sounds kind of fun compared to this.
This ball hammered to deep right, way back. Take a good look. You won't see it for long. 1-0 Colorado.
All right. And I'm not proud of this, but at the end of the fourth inning, I left. And it turns out I was right. The Mets lost 3-2.
We'll make this work, okay?
Okay.
Goodbye.
Okay, thanks, buddy. This is 161st Street, Yankee Stadium. Transfer is available to the floor.
The Mets game wasn't the only game in town. We also went to a Yankees game. We were in the unvaccinated section this time. And in this section, we had to socially distance, which turns out it was quite nice. It was like going business class.
Where are our seats? Okay.
Where are we?
420.
Now, to me, the Yankees are Pfizer, and the Mets are Moderna. And the Yankees were going to play the White Sox, who are, of course, bleach. Sitting two rows behind the loudest person in America. We are in a section that is as high as you can get without being on the roof. And when I say high, I don't mean performance-enhancing drugs. And yet, it is still, even from miles above the field, it's gorgeous. Oh, wait a minute.
Wait, okay.
Did he get...
So he got to...
Tagged out? He must have. They'd be cheering.
Okay, you can always... Two outs,
but the guy running home got tagged out.
Okay.
That's bad.
Oh, see, I thought we were going to have bases loaded, but we don't. Okay.
No. 2 outs.
There was a Fellini-esque quality to the night too, which was that at some point Stephen and I noticed that the stadium was filling up with young people in, say, their 20s who were all wearing purple graduation gowns and mortar boards.
Thank you for being so conveniently located to us.
Thank you.
Could you tell me why you're here and did you graduate today or do you just love wearing the gown?
So on the first day of freshman year, we were told that we would be graduating here at Yankee Stadium last Wednesday. So we figured we'd come to Yankee in our attire anyways and have a good time.
How was your last year being there but not there?
It wasn't the same. The city was empty for most of the year. The professors did a good job for the most part, but it didn't really capture the full college experience.
With that being said, we got some really cool opportunities that we wouldn't have. We got to climb the Wall Street Bull and ride that. We got to swim in the fountains. There were so many things we could do because there were no people.
Until the ninth inning, the game was good, but you had to be kind of an expert to appreciate it because what was good was the pitching. So it was a tied game 1-1 at the top of the ninth. The White Sox come up. They get two hits. There's a man on first and a man on second. And
grounded to third. There's one. There's two. There it is. It's a triple play. They get a triple play to get out of the jam.
And the bottom of the ninth was wonderful. Aaron Judge hits a single. Gia Urshelet hits another single. Now there's a guy on first and a guy on second. Gleyber Torres, who has just returned from having been sidelined because of COVID, is up to bat. He hits a grounder past the shortstop into left field. Judge rounds third. There's chaos. And he beats the ball to the plate. And the Yankees win.
A good day at the ballpark for Patricia Mark. She's a longtime staff writer. Stephen Valentino is one of our producers.
That was exciting, and I'm not just saying that because I've been locked up for 14 months.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This is the first weekend of Pride Month, and we're joined now by an important figure of queer history. Sarah Schulman is a writer, the author of 10 or more novels, but she's better known as an activist. She fought for reproductive rights and gay rights, and she was a member of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. For 20 years, Sarah Schulman has run the ACT UP Oral History Project along with Jim Hubbard, and they've interviewed surviving members of the group. And out of that work, she's written a history of ACT UP in its early days, when they employed radical tactics to force America to acknowledge at last the disease as a public health crisis.
Well, here's an example. So I participated in Stop the Church. This is when the church tried to stop condom distribution in the public schools and ACT UP decided to disrupt mass. This was in December of 1989. We had a big discussion inside the organization of how are we going to organize this. Now, I think ACT UP was primarily Catholic and Jewish, but there were Protestants, and they were concerned about the organization looking anti-Catholic. The Jews and the Catholics were not concerned about that at all. But so the compromise was that we were going to do a silent die-in during Mass. And so we went into the church. There were 7,000 people outside. It was ACT UP's largest demonstration. And we were ready to do the silent die-in when one member, Michael Petrelis, jumped on the pew and started screaming at Cardinal O'Connor. You're killing us. You're killing us. Stop it. Stop it. And all pandemonium broke loose, and the police were everywhere. People were screaming and throwing things, and it was crazy, and a bunch of people got arrested.
Sarah, I have a pretty clear memory of ACT UP, as anybody of a certain age might. What was ACT UP, and what role did it play in the politics of AIDS?
So just to give a little background, there's a famous New York Times article, July 3rd, 1981, 41 cases of cancer found among homosexuals in San Francisco. So that was the public dawning of the disease.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
The scientists say this probably means they are dealing with some new deadly sexually transmitted disease.
The first 5 years of AIDS in America were extremely chaotic. 40,000 people died. The government did absolutely nothing.
It's known as gay plague. No, it is. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing that one in every three people that get this have died, and I wonder if the president is aware of it.
I don't have it. Are you? Do you?
You don't have it. Well, I'm relieved to hear that, Larry.
Do you?
No,
you didn't answer my question.
Well, I just wondered,
how do you know?
Does the president, in other words, the White House looks on this as a great joke?
No, I don't know anything about it, Lester.
Does anybody in the White House know about this epidemic, Larry?
I don't think so. I don't think there's
nobody
been any.
Knows.
There's been no personal experience here, Lester.
No, I mean, I thought you were keeping...
I checked thoroughly with Dr. Ruge this morning, and he's had no patients suffered from AIDS or whatever it is.
So that's Larry Speaks, President Reagan's press secretary in 1982, early in the crisis, making jokes, and it's really startling to hear it now.
Yeah. Within the gay community, there was a lot of chaos, and most of the organizations that were created at first were service organizations, but there was no political response. Finally, in 1987, ACT UP began.
What would you say were its main victories and achievements?
So ACT UP forced science and pharma to restructure. ACT UP forced the Food and Drug Administration to give people access to experimental drugs that had not been approved. ACT UP forced the government to change its definition of AIDS so that symptoms that only women got would be included. This was a four-year campaign. Women with AIDS could not get benefits and could not get access to experimental drug trials until ACT UP's campaign. ACT UP made needle exchange legal in New York City, which transformed the crisis in the city. And in a very large sense, ACT UP changed the way that queer people and people with AIDS saw themselves and were seen by others. Because before ACT UP, the only image of people with AIDS in the media were emaciated, weak people dying in their beds.
I would ask you this. When ACT UP started to conceive itself, did it base its voice, did it base its sense of organization on any other political group of the past, whether it was in racial politics, whether it was in any realm of politics before?
Not consciously. And that's something that's very interesting. So there were individuals in ACT UP who had been in previous movements, in the Black Panthers, certainly in the reproductive rights movement, in Latin American anti-fascist student movements. And they brought strategies and tactics from that those movements. And in the book, I can name who these people are and which tactics they brought in. But there was a larger zeitgeist issue of influence. So I was born in the 1950s, and a lot of people in ACT UP were born in the 50s and 60s. So when we were queer children, we had no concept that there was a gay community waiting for us out there or a gay movement. But we did see Black resistance. You know, we saw images of Black people on television, in Life magazine, in Jet magazine. A number of people's families participated in those movements. And they were doing nonviolent direct action. Famously, Black students sitting at segregated lunch counters, this sort of thing. And I think that young gay kids really identified with these images of resistance and internalized these tactics. Because later, when I was working on the book, I reread Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail, where he lays out his definition of direct action. And it is almost identically what ACT UP did, although we never acknowledged it at the time. So it was something that I think our generation had internalized.
You try to complicate, and I think quite successfully, complicate the picture of what was happening in terms of AIDS, that this was not only white gay men who were at the forefront of ACT UP for so long.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, in America, we love the white male hero. We love John Wayne, and we're always looking for that single person to come rescue us. So the history of ACT UP has been very narrowed to just a handful of white male individuals who have been presented as the heroes. But actually, there were wide range of people, many other kinds of white men, and also people of color, and many women in ACT UP who were in leadership, who drove the organization forward. The reason that they were not represented is quite interesting. In the 1980s, the media was entirely white and male. You know, there was no Joy Reid, no Rachel Maddow at the time. The government was white male. The private sector was white and male. And if there were gay men in those power apparatuses, they were closeted.
Sarah, I think one figure that we should talk about was Larry Kramer, playwright, novelist, and a leader of ACT UP, and probably at least in some tellings of history of ACT UP and the broader gay movement, that the confrontation between, say, Larry Kramer and one Tony Fauci was something that was pivotal. You are not easy on Larry Kramer in your book. Why is that?
Well, you know, I interviewed 188 surviving members of ACT UP, and not one person thinks that Larry Kramer was the leader of ACT UP. So Larry being constructed as the leader of ACT UP is a media construction. Fauci, this is quite interesting because I submitted the manuscript before the second coming of Anthony Fauci. And so he really wasn't in my mind when I was organizing it. But looking back, you can see in the book that every time an innovative idea came out of ACT UP that was presented to Fauci, he said no.
And Fauci was what at that time? What role was he playing in the medical bureaucracy?
Same job he has now.
Yeah.
So, you know, Richard Elovich, who was a leader in ACT UP of IV drug users, he confronted Fauci about drug users being excluded from experimental drug trials. And Fauci said that they shouldn't be included because they were not a reliable community. And Richard was like, no, you cannot exclude an entire class of people.
But didn't Fauci have a kind of conversion experience to some extent?
He was forced to change. ACT UP did huge demonstrations surrounding the NIH.
This is an acyclovir molecule. It's representing that there's treatments out there that the NIH isn't testing. They're not testing high doses of acyclovir as prophylaxis against CMV.
I mean, he really was an object of ACT UP's ire, and he ultimately realized that he needed to work with ACT UP.
But isn't that what activism should do? In other words, to push someone to the point where they change and are able to then affect change within the bureaucracy.
Hopefully, but then there are people who understand from the beginning. I'm thinking of Ruth Messenger, for example, who almost became our mayor at one point.
Ruth Messenger didn't have power the way Fauci did, or to say nothing of Ronald Reagan is what I'm suggesting. I'm not excusing Fauci's behavior in the beginning, but he had power to affect change, and ACT UP was incredibly effective in pushing him toward it.
Yes, I'm not attacking him nor excusing him. I'm just reporting that he was resistant to innovative ideas and had to be brought around.
Tell me a little bit about how you feel about Angels in America, the play by Tony Kushner, which had an incredible following, highly celebrated, and I think you have critical things to say about Tony Kushner and Angels.
Well, you know, we have to look at the most rewarded works about AIDS in our time and what their message is and what is the source of the reward with those pieces. And I look at a few different works. I look at the movie Philadelphia by Jonathan Demme, which won an Oscar, which had a story of a gay man with AIDS who needs a lawyer. So he goes to a homophobic lawyer played by Denzel, and then Denzel heroically overcomes his prejudices to help the poor, alone gay man. In real life, he would have gone to a gay lawyer. But the conceit of the film is that there are no gay lawyers and there is no gay community, and gay people are dependent on straight people. And in Angels in America, there's a similar construction where a man abandons his boyfriend who has AIDS, which I can tell you almost never happened. I mean, the people who were abandoned were people with AIDS were abandoned by their families. That was the abandonment. But in Angels, so the treacherous, betraying homosexual abandons his partner. And this was something that people, the public or the reward system, loved and upheld and did not question.
You interviewed so many people for your book. Did you talk at all with Tony Kushner?
He was not in ACT UP, but I did interview Stephen Spinella, who was an ACT UP activist, and I asked him some questions about this.
Who was Stephen Spinella?
He played Prior Walter. He won a Tony, I think two maybe, for that play. And I asked him about this representation of gay people as abandoning and treacherous and betraying, and there being no gay community and no support for people with AIDS as there was in real life. And he said he hadn't really thought about it.
Sarah, your book is not only history, it's also in some sense a tactical guide to activism today. What lessons do you think that the history of ACT UP and your involvement in ACT UP gives us today in terms of contemporary movements?
Oh, the takeaways from ACT UP are very important for movements today. I think the most important is that ACT UP was not a consensus-based movement. People did not have to agree in order for actions to go forward. There was a one-line principle of unity, direct action to end the AIDS crisis, and that was direct action as opposed to social service provision. So if you were doing direct action to end the AIDS crisis, you could do it. And if I didn't like it, I might argue with you, but I wouldn't try to stop you from doing it. I just wouldn't do it. And I would go off with my people and organize what we wanted to do. And as a result, the wide range of action and the different milieu and levels at which ACT UP responded was so broad that it created a kind of simultaneity of response. And that was a great contributor to the paradigm shift. So I think the big message is radical democracy inside your organizations, big tent politics, and, you know, the kind of movements that enable people to respond from where they're at in a way that makes sense to them. You know, I think that ACT UP really was the most recent successful social movement in America. And it wasn't entirely successful, but it did achieve a paradigm shift. And that's why this book is not nostalgia, but is actually something that can be helpful to activists today. Because getting information about strategies and tactics of movements is very, very difficult to do.
What mistakes did the organization make?
I think ACT UP's biggest mistake was that we lost track of the question of access. And in fact, today...
What do you mean by that?
Well, the drugs that... If you are infected with HIV today, the drugs exist that you can live a normal lifespan. However, not everyone has access to those drugs. We still see people dying of AIDS. We still see people who are not diagnosed until they get into the emergency room. Linda Villarosa, the reporter for the New York Times, showed that Today, black gay men in the U.S. South have a higher rate of AIDS infection than any country in the world. So even though we could defeat HIV, in a sense, we could not defeat capitalism. And we still don't have a logical and coherent healthcare system in this country.
If you could go back to the early 90s, when you were fighting with ACT UP, and leave a voice message for the young queer person growing up in New York City today or anywhere else on the other side of medicine for HIV, what would you tell them?
Well, I think the most exciting thing for young queer people today is that all of our most radical movements right now, the movement against police violence, the movement for Black Lives, the movement for immigration reform, Palestine solidarity, all of these movements have openly queer and trans people in leadership. And so people can be queer and take their place in any socially progressive movement.
Sarah Shulman, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Sarah Shulman's new book about ACT UP is Let the Record Show. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Of all the many reasons to be happy about the decline in COVID cases here in the U.S., one is definitely the chance to hear great musicians playing live. There's nothing like it. But for a long time, that was denied to us. Back in the fall, two of the very best musicians sat together on a stage to play some of Beethoven's sonatas. They were there all alone, the cellist Yo-Yo Ma and the pianist Emmanuel Ax. This was for the New Yorker Festival, a virtual festival by necessity, and it happened to be shortly before the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth. We'll hear an excerpt from their amazing performance, and then they'll talk with New Yorker music critic Alex Ross, who was listening from home. Here's Emmanuel Ax on piano and Yo-Yo Ma on cello. Thank you.
So, Alex, what did you think?
I'm not here wearing my critic hat.
Do you still like the piece?
More than ever. Thank you so much. That was magnificent to hear, and it's just splendid to see both of you from a distance. Our first question was actually, when did you first play a Beethoven cello sonata together, and what is it like now to find your way to a new reading of the piece, having played together so often?
I'd like to start, and then I'd like Manny to continue,
okay.
Because I've known Manny, we've known each other for over 43 years.
Yeah.
And we probably played this very early on in our, playing this piece for over 40 years.
Over 40 years.
A couple months ago, Manny said, Yo-Yo, did you know that there's this dedication that I never knew about?
This piece, one of the things that completely astounded me was that this is such positive, beautiful, open, hopeful music. And his patron, the one he dedicated the piece to, Beethoven sent him the copy, you know, of the manuscript with an inscription that said, "Amid tears and sorrow."
And so we were sort of asking ourselves, what gives?
Yeah.
And we look up the date when he wrote this, which was in 1809.
Yeah, 1808, 1809 and is so the years when he was writing this.
We realize that that's the year that Napoleon invaded Austria, Wagram, right outside of Vienna.
Yeah.
So imagine you're living in this city and this foreign power comes in and takes over your town.
Yeah.
And just realizing the parallel, here's Beethoven, who has endured so many tough moments in his life.
Yeah, there's also, right at just that moment, also the personal side. I mean, he's a musician, he's losing his hearing. And between that, what's going on around him in the city, what's going on in the country, there's this music, which is hopeful, beautiful, generous,
noble,
all of those things.
And I thought this is a good piece for this moment because, you know, people are suffering. And we do think that music can give comfort.
Yeah, it does. It has that quality of serenity and contentment and joyfulness, but it's not an oblivious kind of joy.
Quite right. There's in the middle, there's a very tearful spot, but it's just one place. Yeah, I mean, that's terribly, terribly poignant, terribly sad. But again, it's just one episode in this general feeling of hope, at least to me. I mean, these are all personal reactions for us, of course.
Let's get into sort of some of the nuts and bolts of, you know, certain gestures that are just so innately Beethoven that are present in this piece and elsewhere in the cello sonatas. And one thing that you mentioned we were talking before is just this very basic musical gesture, which is sort of the most basic there is. 1-5-1, we call it, a tonic dominant, the home key,
as Yo-Yo said, tension, arrival, you know. And,
right.
And he makes it incredibly plain, almost monomaniacal, since that we start in this key, and then he stops. What's going to happen next? When are we going to get back home? And he does this 5 or 6 times in the movement. And there are so many examples through Beethoven of this sort of thing.
Give some examples.
The Waldstein Piano Sonata.
Just play.
What's he gonna do next? Fifth Symphony. same idea. What I love particularly. Sorry?
How does he end the movement?
What you mean, the
fifth
symphony?
Yeah.
He just he finally decides he's going to let you have it with both barrels. So you know, you've ended on the right note. What I particularly love in this sonata is that we finally, the last time we do this, finally, he's going to say, okay, let the cello get. But then the piano says, are you sure? Yes, I'm
very sure. I'm so very sure. Yes, I am very, very.
You know, yeah, we get it.
What Manny's describing is, you know, it's technique. Beethoven uses a certain technique to get to a certain point. We recognize that technique. So by really owning that technique, that gives us the freedom to be able to express and say, we actually know the guy. and I think I grew up, I don't know how you grew up, but I certainly grew up, and I think Manny also, you know, we say, okay, Albert Einstein, he's a genius. There's no way we can approach whatever he does. Beethoven, he's so, you know, certain people seem unapproachable. Yeah. But with Beethoven, I think the more you know, you feel that with actually quite a number of composers, the idea that what used to be not ours becomes ours. Mm-hmm. And it's our music.
But it's also the opposite of familiarity breeds contempt.
Right.
It's this familiarity breeds more and more amazement.
Let's step back and talk about the cello sonatas and what sort of drove Beethoven to take up this form. And he really was inventing a form to some extent. I mean, there weren't examples of these sort of statements in this form with the cello and the piano evenly balanced. And so what do both of you notice about how Beethoven is going about bringing all of his firepower to a form that had sort of much less of a track record than violin sonata, piano sonata, and so on?
Well, in this age of inequality and inequity, I think Beethoven felt that during his time also. Mm-hmm. The cello was a poor, poor relative to the violin and the piano. And so I think he took pity on the cello and decided that he wanted to, you know, spotlight the cello. So the fourth sonata
also.
And then the piano responds. And the triple concerto, which is very much close to the cello, always gets the tune first. It's got to be intentional after a certain amount of time.
Yes. I think there's a nobility to the cello sound that he somehow intuited and loved. And you get that in these pieces well. And he was very concerned, we know, in the A major sonata, we're lucky enough to actually have an autograph, a working autograph, where he made changes. And he spent a lot of time not thinking about what the tunes were going to be, but who was going to play them. You know, so he would very often say the piano would do this. No, I'm going to have the cello do this. And this constant readjustment, and most of it in order to highlight the cello more.
You know, he wrote 10 violin sonatas. He wrote 32 piano sonatas. But he wrote 5 piano cello sonatas. And I think each one is kind of a different invention. And in each case, it's to describe an even more effervescent universe as he got to later and later stages. The middle one is the one where societal stresses got him to say, no, I'm going to actually do something unbelievably beautiful and comforting. There was so much change that happened during his lifetime. There's so much change that's happening right now. And how do we actually hold on to certain values? And Beethoven certainly was maniacal about holding on to the values he believed in spite of change. And that's something that we think about also.
Right, yeah. This issue of how Beethoven responded to the turmoil of his time mirrors what we are all living through now. And I'm wondering, as you've been playing in recent weeks and months, often in quite unusual circumstances, and I know you've been doing these pandemic outdoor distanced events, riding around on a sort of custom-built yo-yo and Manny truck to different places. First of all, what does the music sort of mean to you under those circumstances, and has it changed how you have played it in any kind of palpable way?
I would love to think that what I'm doing with music is helping people in some way. It would certainly help me to play music and to listen to music. I hope that's true for, if not everybody, for some people.
I'd like to say that, you know, one of the things that we were asking ourselves is, well, what is our purpose? Right. And it's obvious that our purpose is not to say we only exist in the four walls of concert halls. That music obviously exists in people's minds. It exists at funerals. It exists at bar mitzvahs, at weddings, at rites of passage, at teenagers. You know, it's like music is something that keeps us going and gives not only gives us comfort, but actually puts us in very specific states of mind, as we were kind of showing a little bit with little bits and pieces of Beethoven. And also, music, it's always individual. The aesthetic experience starts at the personal, individual level. So you don't have to play for 1,000 people. You can play for one person in a hospital room. And in that sense, we find our purpose by knowing how and when we can help. What we did in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, is that Manny had this wonderful friend who's been moving pianos for 30 years, yeah, Stefan. He said, use my flatbed. Yeah. And Blue Q in Pittsfield, yeah, this arts company said, fine, we'll build you a stage set, you know. And yeah, they came in and 4 hours, yeah, they built this kind of...
And the Yamaha dealer said, sure, we'll give you Klavanova to put on this,
yeah,
thing.
And the BSO gave us the stairs to go up. So this was a Stone Soup moment where we just all put in something, and the city of Pittsfield said, you know, come, go to the UPS workers there, you can go to this elementary school, you can go
but
to
you
this.
Know what we discovered also, there's a lot of wonderful people in the world,
yeah,
who are doing fabulous things. So for us, it was an amazing thing.
And this also just strengthens like sort of our belief that our circumstances may change, our lives may change, but there's something in music that remains constant, and it offers something. We should always respond to need. This was one of the pieces we played for essential workers,
on the truck, and
pop-ups, and we thought that this is, again, part of that same idea of in the midst of great discomfort, you can find certain types of comfort in music.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Emmanuel Ax on piano and Yo-Yo Ma on the cello. They played Beethoven's Cello Sonata No. 3 in A major. And they spoke with Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker. Alex's most recent book is called Wagnerism. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Hope you enjoy the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund. Thank you.